right, we're going to start on time. This is session 133, A Gay Mormon Diaspora, exploring the act of testimony and belief in the case study of young single adult Mormons. And we're so grateful that you guys came. I'm Meredith Bossuier, and I'm moderating. And I'd just like to introduce Kevin Lewis, the presenter. He is pursuing a Bachelor of Science in Anthropology with minors in Religious Studies and Writing. He received the MT Lambda LGBT Plus Scholarship in 2013. So this should be great, and I'll turn the time over to Kevin.
Thank you.
Doing? Is everybody good? Cool. So yeah, I'm Kevin. I am originally from Pocatello, Idaho. I live in Middle Tennessee, or right now I go to Middle Tennessee State University, MTSU. I'm in my senior year, or about to start my senior year. So yeah, it's been a good time. So this, I'll kind of tell you about this paper and why I decided to pursue it. Coming from Pocatello but not being raised Mormon, like you kind of know a lot about the church, but not a whole lot. And so we have one church in this town that I live in, just one church building. So that's kind of a culture shock when you come from the Mormon bubble, as we call it. So I talked to my advisor, and she's like, yeah, go hang out with the Mormons. And I was like, okay, cool. So started hanging out with them, and then just got really interested in LGBT identity, because being such a small community, they all kind of stick together, even though some of what they do isn't exactly what the church would agree with as a whole, which is really fascinating because they are still very much Mormon. But there is definitely, there's kids in the church who definitely identify as gay, and they still come to church every Sunday. So yeah, it's really cool. But I'm just gonna read y'all my paper because I feel like that's the easiest way. A couple of things on the paper I'm going to draw because I hate PowerPoint and I feel like drawing them makes it make more sense. So I'm going to do that, and then afterwards we'll have some time for questions, and you'll probably get out of here early and go to lunch. So, but I do want to say thank you for everyone at Sunstone for letting me come, and my mom came, which I haven't seen my mom for 2 years, so woohoo. And then for everyone who helped out the paper, it's awesome. So yeah, here we go. Everyone is so happy. I really love Testimony Week, says a young woman in no more than her mid-20s, standing at the podium. She goes on to relate in a gentle southern drawl her experience of gaining testimony of Heavenly Father's awareness of her. Other members of the congregation immediately follow. All of the women are dressed in similar modest attire, the men in smooth black suit and ties. Each begins by saying, I want to bear my testimony, and each relates what is perceived to be an individual and unique experience. For some, it is of the power of fasting. For others, it is prayer. And others still, it is of their duty to lay the foundation of Zion in these latter days. Each recounts how their testimony has been strengthened by day-to-day experiences, and each concludes with, I testify that this church is true, that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, that Joseph Smith was a prophet, or various similar statements. The act of testifying before the church serves as a focal point for these young single adults of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Testimony is the product of lived experience. Within this context, an individual's act of testifying serves as a space in which the mundane of the everyday is elevated into the realm of the spiritual and inspirational. Testimony is a living and dynamic vehicle which is navigated by the doctrine and teachings of the church, and it is through the navigation of the daily life that one's testimony is created. Every moment becomes a lesson, the eventual result of which is a further refined testimony. The refinement of testimony results in a worldview where both the individual and communal identity is molded through lived experiences of day-to-day inspirational monotony, all of which leads to a particular conception of forever. This paper is based upon ethnographic fieldwork I conducted during the fall of 2014 at a local LDS church near my college in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. In this paper, I will do three things. First, I will begin by describing my ethnographic field site and offer some insights into both the community and the physical site where I conducted my research. Second, I will discuss the role testimony plays in the social world of this particular form of Christianity. In doing so, I will draw upon contemporary theories from an emerging field known as the anthropology of Christianity. In particular, I look at the way that testimony as a performative language act allows for certain constructions of Mormon identity, understandings of time, and the role of marriage in the context of Mormon cosmologies. Finally, I conclude my paper by drawing upon an in-depth interview conducted with one of my interlocutors This interview explores the way that sexual identity is also framed discursively in the context of his particular understanding of his own identity as a gay Mormon. So Mormons of Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Some of this you guys are going to be super familiar with because you've been to church, Mormon church, and this was my first real time like being in a Mormon church consecutively. So you might think some of it's boring, but I thought everything was fascinating.
Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I was like, wow. Anyways, so I began attending the YSA ward in Murfreesboro in October 2014 for a period of 5 consecutive weeks. The YSA branch, which was originally established in the spring of 2013, averaged a weekly attendance of 45 to 50 members during my visits. So if that tells you anything about how small this community is, like 50 members was the average for 5 weeks. This ward, as its name states, is made up of young, mostly college-age, single Mormons with some high school students in the mix. Males comprised slightly more than 50% of this congregation, and there was some, though not much, ethnic diversity. Those of non-European descent numbered between 10 to 15 members on any given Sunday. The building, located less than half a mile from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University, was originally constructed in the 1980s and consisted of a small meeting room and baptismal font. The initial membership was sparse, but the congregation increased steadily in the ensuing decades, and the church was remodeled to accommodate the growing numbers. And, like, the church is funny compared to, I guess, standard churches, because you have like your chapel area, but then you have like halls and stuff that are added on, so the church is laid out really weird compared to just typical churches, so it's easy to get lost, and it's not a very big building. And all the kids at the church that like had pointed that out, that the church is laid out weird, and I thought it was crazy. The construction and decor of the Murfreesboro ward is simple. The cream-colored halls are lined with community bulletins and calendars outlining weekly and monthly events. On one wall are pictures of the young men and women who are currently serving their missions. There are also large frame paintings of Jesus teaching in both Palestine and the Americas. The notion that Jesus visited and taught in the Americas is one of the most notable identity markers that separate the LDS Church from other varieties of Christianity. Thus, these images are striking in their capacity to instruct visually LDS members of their own theology while simultaneously drawing them into a larger Christian narrative. Missing are the images of the cross, the crucified Christ, and the empty tomb that are so often seen in other Christian sites of worship. Most noteworthy to me was the large slogan posted on one wall that reads, "Families are forever." The related notion of eternal family turned out to be one of the most intriguing concepts I uncovered during my fieldwork. The chapel, what stands apart from the rest of the building, is particularly notable because it lacked any kind of iconography. None of the images with which one might be familiar or expect from other forms of popular Christianity are found. When I asked about the lack of images in the chapel, members informed me that this absence was something they had not really thought of before. Moreover, they suggested that since the chapel is where they participate in sacrament, partaking of bread and water, perhaps the lack of images reinforces a time of individual introspection. While visiting the community, I remained a casual observer, opting to not participate in sacrament or prayer. I usually would sit near the back and take notes about the lengthy Sunday services. The first portion lasts approximately 1 hour and consists of the sacrament service, which serves several purposes. First, the service involves a partaking of sacrament, a reminder of Christ's sacrifice and the atonement. Second, in this hour, messages are delivered to the entire congregation. These messages consisted of several mini-messages that were delivered by lay members of the congregation rather than by the bishop or president. It is during this hour that on the first Sunday of the month, Fast Sunday, that all members are given the opportunity to bear their testimony. The second hour was set aside for Sunday school, which consisted of several different classes one could attend: gospel doctrine, gospel principles, and missionary prep. Doctrine and principles are two classes that are standard in every LDS church and occur, I was told, in every ward around the globe, so much so that one could attend any number of wards in consecutive weeks and not miss a lesson. During my fieldwork, this ward also had a third class, missionary prep, which was geared toward prepping young future missionaries to share the gospel. Each of these classes were made up of equal parts men and women. In the third hour, the men and women separated, the women to attend Relief Society, and the men went to the Elders Quorum. This third period, similar to the first two, consists of a hymn, a brief lesson, and the brief lesson from the scriptures or previous talks and prayer. In each of these hour-long services, prayer, introspection, and the study of doctrine and scripture are central. It is, however, the use of the phrase, "I testify," that is the most common denominator between the 3 hours. The term signifies a moment of affirmation in which one asserts not only their own sincerity of belief, but also the sincerity of the church as a whole, and perhaps even of God. So I testify as an act of conversion. My argument is the act of testifying creates a division in definite epochs in linear time, which works to maintain clear boundaries between a pre-Mormon past and the present. This temporal model draws from the work of Olivia Harris, who conducted fieldwork among the northern Potosi of Bolivia, wherein she observes that as, quote, a conversion religion, Christianity creates an absolute break between a pre-Christian past and the present with its hope of salvation. By converting, the linear temporal scheme is ruptured, and there are created moments of eternal return. According to Harris, quote, conversion is a permanent process constantly renewed in ecstatic confession, end quote. To Harris' argument concerning the role of conversion, I add the Mormon practice of testifying. By testifying time and again to the truth of the church and the authority of the prophets, the individual in the present steps out of linear time and into a past moment of rupture. This rupture is conceived individually not only as the moment of initial revelation or conversion, but also is negotiated on a communal level vis-a-vis the revelation first given to Joseph Smith. Thus, the act of testifying allows the individual to recreate time and again this original moment. And so this is where we're going to draw our first picture. Okay, so you got linear time, you know, past, present, future, pretty simple. So we're here in the present. So you have this past moment. This past moment is the moment of rupture, and that rupture is at Joseph Smith, where he receives revelation from God. So by receiving revelation of God, that's this moment of rupture. By testifying, the individual in the present steps out of linear time through the use of their language, the use of words, and it is as though they themselves... So they themselves were at that moment of original rupture. So they experience it for themselves. But they don't experience it just once. They experience it over and over and over and over again through their act of testifying over and over again. Cool? Okay, that's your first picture. Okay, so I testify as an act of sincerity is the next section. It is through the appeal to the moment of rupture that the individual defines themselves both as against and as transcending the world. Since both testimony and revelation take the form of language, the act of testimony also demands that the authority for the words be found in the speaker as the, quote, responsible party. In considering the ways that language and authority are negotiated, I am drawing upon a model of language ideologies developed by Webb Keen, who argues that within Christianity specifically, and Western society more generally, there is a notion that the act of speaking can reveal something about the character of the speaker. Excuse me. That is, quote, that the words spoken are an outward display of an abstract and internal state of being, end quote. Keen explains that Christian notions of sincerity are presupposed upon the notion that the speaker does in fact know herself. Knowing the self is vital, as the words that are spoken can and will be judged and evaluated by the community. This practice becomes important within a Christian context when a particular individual wants to lay claim to salvation. For example, within evangelical Christianity, an individual might proclaim to be born again, a point which denotes a shifting ontological identity. Other members of the community must gauge, using words as evidence, the sincerity of the individual's statement. This practice of external evaluation, however, introduces the possibility that the speaker can be deemed insincere. Others can make this judgment because sincerity is interactive. As Webb Keen explains, quote, for in being sincere, I am not only producing words that are transparent to my inner states, but I am producing them for you, end quote. In the case of the LDS Church, the public act of testimony means that the speaker reasserts both her own and the community's sincerity. In so doing, her belief alongside that of the church and thereby all its extensions are also sincere. So we're going to add on to this. This act of testifying reveals sincerity about this individual. So there, by saying I testify the church is true, I'm telling you something about who I am on my inside. But it's not just about who I am on the inside, it's about everyone else before me. So, and not just, and it's not even just other people before me, it's also about, you know, your doctrines, your books, all these things. So it's not just that I'm being sincere, it's that I'm being sincere and the whole church is also sincere. We all testify and we're all sincere in our belief. Okay, next section is marriage and family. Families are central to the church and are seen as the main building block of society. Marriage, which for Mormons is only between one man and one woman, is viewed as something that lasts not only in this life, till death do we part, but is instead for time and eternity. It is through eternal marriage performed in one of the Mormon temples that families are sealed together for eternity. This eternal perspective was emphasized, as previously stated, on one of the church's walls, which bears a poster that reads, "Families are forever." The benefits of eternal marriage do not just come after death. Rather, they are part of the present world as well. These benefits include the blessings of children and the knowledge that nothing, except for the individual's own disobedience, can separate them from their family. So forever and eternity are two words that came up repeatedly during the course of my fieldwork. The use of these words are similar to what Rebecca King calls temporal adverbs, in which she argues in her study of progressive Christians take on an eschatological nature by directing attention away from the present to an inaccessible future. I would argue that King's theory can be extended to Christianity in general and is particularly suited to thinking about Mormon conceptions of the future as a discursively constructed possibility. Unlike progressive or mainline Christians, Mormons have a peculiar type of access to the future and eternity through temple work. It is through the use of temporal adverbs that King's progressive Christians, much like in the Return to the Moment of Conversion, quote, position themselves as followers or participants on a specific temporally oriented theological trajectory. End quote. This position introduces an identification of, quote, two futures, the near future and the ideal distant future, or eschatological future. End quote. For Mormons, it is the near future that the individual finds a partner and through the act of temple marriage is eternally sealed and thus gains access to the distant or ideal future. In so doing, the individual asserts his or her authority over time and space, bringing the distant eschatological future into the present, in a sense moving heaven to earth and thus receiving all the blessings that come with an eternal marriage. These blessings include being eternally sealed to one another as well as the children that are the product of the union, being sealed to their parents. It is important to note these blessings are revealed and located in the future and exist only in the present as far as they are imagined. In other words, I argue eternal marriage constitutes a temporal break in which the adherents temporarily occupy an imagined space in the future. I will add that it is not just the act of marriage that moves heaven to earth, but acts that reflect the eternal union through family building. That is to say, that through particular acts, sex and childbirth, one moves from the standard temporal plane into one that is both future and eternal. After this break in the temporal narrative, the individual returns to the present and continues along a standard chronological trajectory in which they are always and already moving back to the future. Okay, so we're going to draw one more
picture here. Okay, so you have your near future, which is here, where your Mr. Mormon meets Mrs. Mormon. They get married, they go to the temple. And the temple is unique because the temple stands as a place that is both in the present moment but has the ability to stand outside of the present moment as well. So it kind of gets this thing going on. So it stands present then into eternity, so it's in the moment of the eschaton, right? So everything that happens in the temple has eternal consequences, so it happens in the future. So by going to the temple, getting married, you are stepping into the future, you're being eternally sealed, and then you come back from the temple into the present moment. In the present moment, you have children, you have sex, whatever. These acts, by having children and having sex, take you back into this moment that's into eternity, because you're coming out of that moment, bringing the blessings of eternity back into the present with you. Is that cool? Everyone got it? Okay.
So thus it can be argued Mormon constructs of marriage and family, like the act of testimony, serve as one of the primary spaces in which the larger Mormon cosmology is constructed, legitimated, and maintained. During my brief fieldwork, I encountered several individuals who confided to me that they were gay or bisexual. I did not encounter anyone who claimed to be lesbian or trans. My final section of this paper discusses the way that a shared Mormon and LGBTQ identity might be navigated. This section begins by discussing the LDS teachings on homosexuality and same-sex marriage. I then conclude with an in-depth discussion of an interview I conducted with a gay Mormon who, until recently, was actively involved in the YSA group. I should begin by restating that this research was conducted in the fall of 2014 prior to the ruling on marriage equality and therefore does not necessarily speak to the way same-sex unions are being conceived on a local or national level. And if y'all know anything that the church has said since the ruling on marriage equality, you know that really nothing has changed within the church. So Mormonism and homosexuality. The LDS Church has an involved and lengthy history concerning homosexuality, and more specifically, same-sex marriage. In 1995, former president of the church, Gordon B. Hinckley, in a message to the General Relief Society, read, "The Family, a Proclamation to the World." This proclamation outlines the church's official position on families and reinforces the structure of marriage as between one man and one woman, as well as the roles of men and women in the bonds of marriage. This proclamation also warns that the disintegration of the family will bring upon individuals, communities, and nations the calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets. And then these kind of same statements are made in the recent statement that was made by the church. So while the church holds a hard line on the issue of same-sex marriage, it also possesses an interesting position on the question of homosexual identity. MormonsandGays.org, a church-owned and operated website, states the following. The experience of same-sex attraction is a complex reality for many people. The attraction itself is not a sin, but acting on it is. Even though individuals do not choose to have such attractions, they do choose how to respond to them. With love and understanding, the church reaches out to all God's children, including our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. While acknowledging the existence of same-sex attraction, the church believes that individuals with such desires can remain members as long as they do not act on those feelings. Instead, they are held to the same standards to which those with opposite attraction are held, as outlined in the law of chastity. The church now, unlike in times past, quote, does not necessarily advise those with same-sex attraction to marry those of the opposite sex, end quote. This expectation, I was told in each interview, leaves a gay Mormon to live a life of celibacy. So on being a gay Mormon. In an effort to fully understand what it is to be a gay Mormon, I conducted a series of interviews with several current and former members of the church, some of whom disclosed that they were gay or bisexual. I will note, though, that all of these interlocutors consider themselves to be Mormon, regardless of whether or not they are active or inactive. Among my interlocutors, there was never a disassociation from an individual's Mormon identity, but rather an explanation that it was complicated. Furthermore, all interlocutors asserted that church doctrine, including that pertaining to sexuality, was in fact true. And here I'm going to move into an interview I did. So just follow along really well if you can. So on identity. One interlocutor, Dylan, is an inactive member of the church, originally from Salt Lake City, Utah. He asserts that he is a gay man, but that his identity as a Mormon remains important to him. As evident in his statement, it is still core to my beliefs. In what follows, I quote at length from my interview with Dylan in order to flesh out the ways in which he understands the relationship between his religious identity and his sexuality. Dylan, if anyone asks, I'm gay. I don't go around telling everybody or making it obviously known, but all of my friends know. Me. By having a position that disagrees with the church, where has that put you as a member of the church? Dylan, it puts me in a bit of an awkward position because I know I want to be there, but when I go, I don't feel comfortable because of my own idea of how I should be. Everybody loves me there. Everybody wants me there. There's been no discrimination, no making me feel uncomfortable from anybody else. It's all from my perspective of I just don't feel comfortable because I have an idea of who I should be or how I should be, so that makes me feel like I shouldn't be there. Me. When you say you should or when you say who you should be or how you should be, what does that mean? Dylan. According to the church, when you turn 19, you go on a mission. You come back, get married, start a family. A lot of church doctrine is based on the family unit. I don't see myself being part of a family unit with a wife and children because of the desires that I have. And so being in a group that I'm in, it's all geared toward eventually becoming a family, finding a wife and starting a family. It makes me feel on the outs because it's unattainable to me. Me. When you say this isn't attainable, explain why. Dylan, homosexual relationships are discouraged and frowned upon, and so I would have to marry a woman and start a family in that regard. I don't want to say have to, because that's totally, but that's the idea. I'm not sure how to word it. I would have to put away a lot of my feelings on the back burner or get rid of them all to be able to be part of a family union in that regard to have my own family. And I do not see that as a sacrifice that I can do. I don't have the desire to put that forth, that sacrifice forward, so I'm being selfish in a way. Me, if you were an active and involved member of the church and openly acknowledge that you are a gay man, what are your options if you want to stay involved? Dylan, to not have any homosexual relationships at this point. me, but if you want to receive the blessing of the church, what do you have to do? Dylan, for me, the only thing that I would have to do would be stop going on dates and stop cultivating relationships with other men. Me, so remain celibate? Dylan, yes. On the church. Dylan highlights several things, the first of which that he, even as a disassociated member of the church, still testifies that the church and its doctrine are in fact true. Me, have you always agreed with church doctrine? Dylan, agreed with? Yes. Followed? No. And when asked about changing his religious perspective? Not possible. I've thought about it. I've been to a couple of different churches and more open-minded settings, but it's just never felt complete. On the question of celibacy, me. When I've asked in other interviews, they make it sound so simple. Oh, just be celibate. Dylan, when you get down to it, it is very simple. You just remain celibate. You don't masturbate. You don't watch porn. You don't. And that's the simple basic doctrine. But the root of my problem is the sexual desire in and of itself. That is the root of the problem, which complicates it because it isn't just don't have sex. It's the emotional feeling that go along with it, the base desire. I guess for everybody else, it's when a girl walks into the room and that's what they want. That's what they're looking for. That's what they're taught. And it's easier for them to, you know, not go after it because they've been training themselves to hold off, to wait, and to not want that. But for me, it's always been build relationships with guys, become close with guys, and then I have that desire or that base feeling of wanting something more in that regard, which is very complicated because it clouds the regular friendships that should be there, if that makes sense. He goes on to say, it's easier for me to hold women at a higher standard, not a higher standard, what's the word, to cherish and honor and to be a gentleman that they need, because I don't see them as a sexual object or don't sexualize them in any way. So it's easy for me to put on that perspective. Whereas with guys, it's hard to build that relationship because it's influenced by sexual desires. On eternal marriage and family, me. What about eternal marriage and family? Does this put you in a spot where you're opting yourself out? Dylan, in a sense, yes. Myself, I believe that if I have the desire to and found someone that I could see myself living with for the rest of my life, I believe that I could find a wife and get married and have kids, which would allow me into those blessings of eternal families. But if not, and I live my life completely celibate and participate in the church to my fullest to my fullest ability until I die. The sincerity of God. Dylan's affirmation of his Mormon identity moves him, just as the rest of the community, to the past, to the moment of temporal rupture, which resides in the person of Joseph Smith. However, unlike his heterosexual peers, Dylan, by engaging in homosexual relationships, is restricted to only return to the eternal moment of conversion, never allowed to inhabit the spaces in which he can receive the blessings of eternal marriage and family, only permitted to testify to return to the past, but never be permitted to move to the future, participate in temple marriage, or have eternal families, that is, unless it's with a woman, at which point he deems himself as wholly insincere to himself, his community, and to God. So if we're going to add to this picture,
we have Dylan down here, and he's only allowed to move into this moment. He can only testify that the church is true, which he does. He says the church is true. I agree with the church. Their beliefs are right. So he's only allowed to come here. He's never allowed to move here. This is not possible for him. And if it is possible for him, it is only with somebody of the opposite sex, which then makes him insincere, because then he's a liar. But this right here, in a sense, almost makes God a liar. Because God's a liar because he's not allowed to be who he is. He's not allowed to. So this act of testifying is negated. Because at this point, the church is no longer true. Because he's not allowed to be wholly sincere anymore in who he is.
So, closing thoughts. It is through Dylan's testimony of the church being true that his identity is formed. Every moment for him is a lesson in which a refined testimony, an examination of the self, is created. It is through his testimony, the appeal to the past, that daily life is navigated. His worldview and understanding of the self is created and even recreated in the delivery of his testimony. However, for him, the road that leads to forever is marked not only by inspirational monotony, but also by moments in which the self deems itself as wholly insincere and moments in which he is wholly honest, as well as the moments in which he is wholly honest. And, excuse me, I messed up that whole sentence. So he is limited to exist in temporal liminality, an in-between space connecting eternal conversion and the present, relying on God to make good on his promise of redemption. He says in closing, when I die, God can put me where I belong. I don't know where that would be or how I fit into that, but he would put me where I belong. Thank you. So I'm gonna let you guys ask me questions. Be gentle. Yes, sir.
I have a question. I live in the Avenues here in Salt Lake, just over in San Francisco. And one time all my neighbors were gay or lesbian. And been active in the church. I thought it was kind of an interesting situation. And then we got the recent Supreme Court decision with Justice Kennedy emphasizing that the lack of dignity.
History is any indication of what's going to happen. I mean, when polygamy was outlawed by the Supreme Court, the church put out a statement. It's a wonderful statement. You should go read it because it sounds almost exactly like the statement that they just put out about same-sex marriage. And we all know how that turned out. You know what I mean? A couple years later, churches, there's no polygamy, you know? And so I think that, and I've talked about this with a lot of people, it's not just the LDS church, but the Christian community as a whole is going to have to experience a shift in the way that they deal with LGBT people. Otherwise, the church is no longer going to matter. Like, because they've ostracized a whole portion of our community, or a whole portion of society.
But the young people are completely in tune. They're completely okay with gay marriage. It's just the old guys.
Yeah.
You're going to have to die off.
Yep. Well, I mean, you look at who's in positions of authority within any kind of church community, and it's old, straight, white dudes. You know what I mean? So as new generations take positions of authority, things will change.
It's kind of like all those black people who are not entitled to benefits of the priesthood, and then the church said, oh, well,
never mind.
Just be saved.
Right. Yeah, and I guarantee you, one day, one of the church, the prophet, who is it right now? I'm sorry.
Monson,
yeah, I do that. I mean, at some point, it might not be Monson, it might be somebody after him, is going to say, I had a revelation, and we're going to extend these benefits to gay couples. So, I mean, it's the same thing as, like, the non-discrimination, or not non-discrimination, but integration in the South. So, yeah.
I see this diasporic identity. I missed the beginning, but I think at the end it might be interesting to hear you explain how you think how this relates to the diagram. It seems like, as I try to think about it, that maybe the Jews were kicked out of the Holy Land, so they have no future, and their place of future is the Holy Land. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to?
So the way... That's a wonderful question. So the way that I understand a diasporic identity is almost anyone can take on a diasporic identity. Like you have a place of promise that is your home, that is your place of being, and you're for some reason removed from that. So whether it's the Jews in Palestine or whether it's gay Mormon being able to get married in the temple, it's the same thing. But it's not even so much about him being able to get married in the temple. It's about the fact that he has to put himself in diaspora, take himself out of his church community, out of this family, out of this place that he loves, and like even as far as like removing himself from his own family, and he has to place this to himself in this diaspora community, all while saying, I am going to trust that God is going to put me where I belong when I die. You know, it's the same idea with Jews when they returned to Palestine, or when they were exiled from Palestine. You know, we're leaving our land, and we're heartbroken, and we're destroyed, and we've lost everything, but we anticipate a future day where God will make good on his promise and put us where we belong. Does that kind of help?
Yeah, and so in a way, I think I can visualize this as a gay Mormon, that I no longer fit in the church. The church doesn't want me, just like I may have been kicked out of my home. And a lot of my family don't want me. And so I'm kind of an outsider. I'm creating a world with the Gentiles here, the people that do accept me.
Right.
So I can see a lot of gay Mormons feeling that way. They still have their past, but they don't really have a future.
Well, and it's that we have a past, and we look upon that past with like enthusiasm and joy, like it was this good thing, and we just want to return to that. We want to return to that joy and that euphoria of this happy place, but we can't. So we exile ourselves, or maybe it's God that exiles us. However you want to think about it, that, you know, whatever context you're looking at. So yeah. Yes, sir.
How old is Dylan?
Dylan is 26.
Did Dylan, in your conversations with him, describe his reaction to any negative messaging that he received in the context of his LDS experience?
Okay, so Dylan's got a really interesting experience. I said he's from Salt Lake City. So his family and stuff lives out here, and he lives down in Murfreesboro now. And so at the time of the interview, he hadn't told his family that he was gay yet, and he had just recently started coming out to his LDS community. And I said at the beginning, it's a very small community, and they're all very close-knit. So when he told them that he was gay, they just accepted it. They were like, okay, we're fine with you being gay, but obviously you can't be bringing your boyfriend to church, you can't, you know, but we still want you here. And so, like, I don't know, he experienced some weird, I guess we'll call it weird stuff with the church, because they want him there, but he was expecting this, you need to leave type thing, but he didn't get that. And so, but he still gets this kind of a, you don't have to tell somebody that you don't approve of their lifestyle. You just have to just keep doing what you're already doing, if that makes sense. Because like if you don't speak out and say, I accept you for who you are, and and in the past you have said, we don't accept LGBT people, in whatever way or fashion you've said it, then you're maintaining that same standard. Because if you don't verbally say, I am changing the way that I've thought, and I want you to know that, then it's the same standard all the way through. So you don't have to have the bishop or president of the community come and say, hey, you know, you're gay, and we're not cool with that. Just the fact that they're not saying that is a problem. But his friends in the church still want him to be there. But he's kind of removed himself.
One more question.
No, you're fine.
Excuse me, one more question about this. Did he ever describe to you an experience in which he attempted to get an answer from God about his relationship to God, perhaps independent of his church experience or the expectations that you visualized on the floor for us? Anything at a personal level in which he felt he received some either affirming or non-affirming inspiration from the...
I think that the closest I think that he like had said or anything about that, when he first came out, he tried going to other Christian communities, and he said that it didn't ever feel complete to him, which makes sense because like Mormonism has this foundation of we're bringing the fullness of the gospel back. So he would go to these churches and it just didn't feel complete to him, and so I think that for him, this incomplete feeling in other communities, but this complete feeling in the LDS community, I think that is the closest thing to him knowing that the church is true. but I don't think he would ever say that he ever had a feeling that God still, like that God was just chill with him being gay, because I feel like so much of who God is mediated through the church and through the doctrines and teachings of the church. And so, I mean, unless God comes out of the sky and says, this is going to change, I don't think Dylan or any LGBT person is going to really feel that they are accepted by God or accepted by the church. So, because we only experience God in as much as we experience God through other people. Because, I mean, God, like, you know, you have the Holy Spirit, you have other experiences, but God is experienced through our relationship with other people. And so, and especially within the church, God is experienced through the hierarchy of the church. And so until the hierarchy of the church says, we're going to accept you, I don't think that he'll ever feel that he's exactly accepted or feel that God accepts him. But He lives in this.
Dylan's experience typical? Would you generalize?
Yes.
From what you know about him to.
From what I know about him and what I know about.
The broader population of gay Latter-day Saints.
And not even just gay Latter-day Saints, gay Christian, gay religion. Well, not gay religion. Gay Christian, gay Muslim. Some gay Jews, not really, they don't really care. but yeah, that's typical. So, does that answer your question, though? I feel like I didn't do you justice. Okay, Jason and then you.
I'm curious, with your temporal model, it seems that, like, what's normal and healthy is that the individual in the present has to experience both past and future. But when you're an LGBT individual, you're blocked off from the future. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that sometimes individuals will overcompensate by running repeatedly back to the past? Or is it possible for an alternative future that they can work towards instead of being uniquely focused on the temple like your typical Latter-day Saint? Is there an alternative future that they can reach to that adds to that completeness of spirituality for them?
Well, so our model here, like, where I said it negates the negation happens in that he's not able to move past that, the moment of the eschaton. He's not able to move past that in the here and now, but he's always moving to the future. I mean, we're always moving to the future no matter what. And so he has to, his like eternal experience is just waiting on God to make good on his promise. So, I mean, that's for him. So, and like, as far as like overcompensation, yes, there is so much overcompensation going on, especially among LGBT people who are not out yet, because they get more dedicated in church, they get more honest with God, they're probably some of the more honest people with who they are as far as like their religion, but they're not honest with their communities because they have to live their life a lie. They have to live a life of insincerity. And so they'll do more as far as religion is concerned or as far as their faith is concerned, but it'll never be complete for them because they're not doing it in sincerity. Does that work?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, cool. Yes.
Yeah, at the beginning of your paper, you mentioned you also had contact with bisexual individuals in that community. I'm curious about what contrast you might have seen between the gay members and the bisexual members who might have access in a way to that future, but at the same time, that would be at the expense of blocking off that other part of their identity.
So the bisexual member, I think I'm the only one who knows he's bi, because he told me like during an interview. He's actually getting married, so he's a really interesting person. But I think that he has this like, I mean, you should be jealous of a person who's bi if you're Mormon, because like you're able to still have these feelings, and you're still able to participate in the church, and you're still able to have all these things that the straight members have, but you just don't act on part of your emotional feelings for the same gender. And I totally lost your question. I had it and I lost it. I'm sorry.
About that experience of bisexuality versus homosexuality, whether there was a difference in how they approached their future, I guess.
I think his future is pretty much approached the same way as a straight person is going to be approached. He just negates his same-sex attraction. And, like, I mean, for his wife, I'm assuming that she knows that he's bi or that he's had same-sex encounters. I really just think for him, like, it's just, he's able to just not deal with that part, you know? And I almost think that, like, he's getting married. I mean, Mormons get married so young anyways, but he's getting married so he doesn't have to deal with that anymore. And then you do have so many gay Mormons who do get married because they want to participate in the church and all of these things, and so they can kind of shut off or ignore. You know the play, the Book of Mormon, just turn it off? Yeah. Sorry, I love that play. It was a great play.
It seems like it would still affect the sincerity. Like, example of Dylan, how he, his very being negated the whole sincerity of the story. Mm-hmm. A bisexual Mormon would do the same.
Yeah, so like, but see, he has...
reality is already in contrast.
He has the ability, though, to say, yeah, I'm bi, but I'm married.
Right.
So he's able to be sincere, but he's able to be completely sincere, But what if he was more interested in men than he was in women? But he's not being not sincere. He's just not telling the whole truth. So I mean, he's able to still do this. He's still able to move on this top row. He's still able to participate without being completely insincere. And I don't think it would negate it completely. Yeah. Cool. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
So, 20 years ago, I thought I was, what you're describing, I thought I was bisexual enough to go into the future part. Mm-hmm. And turns out I wasn't. I sat in town for your bisexual friend because, I don't know, if you want to go with current science or Kinsey, there's this huge window of bisexuality, and then there's a small window for gay and straight,
yep.
Right?
Yeah. Does everyone know what the Kinsey scale is? Kinsey scale? Okay, just making sure.
So I thought this therapist put me at a 4 or 5, or I think they said 4.5 or whatever. And because I can't sometimes perform with one woman, I thought I was allowed to have this future. Mm-hmm. And but it made my gay side crazy. stronger and more damaging, and so I had to erase both sides.
Right.
And now I'm trying to be happy in my present. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's ultimately all you can do. Is just be happy in the present. I mean, because in reality, like, even though we have this model where they move into the future and into this eschaton and whatnot, they're still constricted to the present, to this present moment, and into the decisions that they make or don't make. So, like, let's say Mr. Mormon on top, say he was cussing and the bishop heard him or something. Oh, you can't go to temple. You can't do temple rites or whatever. You know, so he can be moved into these moments where he has no future, but he can so easily move back into it. Does that make sense? So, like, for LGBT people, we don't have that. We don't have that ability unless we want to lie. And then if you're lying, if you're living your life as a lie, no one knows except for you and God, and maybe your spouse at some future point. But at the end of it, like, was it better to be honest, or was it better to live your life as a liar? You know, and I mean, that's a real question that the church is forcing people to deal with by not letting them get married in the temple. Is they're demanding that they live their life a lie, or they're demanding that they live their life alone. One of the two things has to happen, and neither is fair. So
both dark answers.
That's really what it is. Yes, sir.
I think your model here shows how complete and sustainable this model is. Mm-hmm. Right now. I think maybe, you know, a couple decades ago when not very many people were out, it could be hidden and it wasn't a big issue. But everyone was gay coming out, and friends and family and everything. It's just going to be more of a pull away, because the time your friends are going to see it, you're going to be able to see the conflict and pain that they're in. They're
going to
have a hard time staying on this timeline as well.
Yeah. Well, and, like, we live in a really weird time because, I mean, the 80s, like, we just went through the AIDS crisis and all the gay people just died, you know? And, like, we were so close, like, the 70s and 80s to getting, like, equality already. Like, we almost had it. And then AIDS hit and we all just died. And so we're finally at that point now where we have recovered our population, the LGBT population. We've demanded those same rights that we were demanding in the first place. But we've done it in such a way that we were very political in what we did. And it wasn't by accident that we were so political, because, like, the LGBT community is very political in what we do, and we have to be. But we did it so well that everyone, if they're being honest with themselves, everyone knows that at least one gay person. They do. And we live in a society where we don't have to be afraid anymore to be gay. I mean, some places we do. Like, down south kind of sucks. But for the most part, we don't have to be afraid to be queer anymore. And it's cool. So it's... And I mean, and like we talked about with the polygamy, or allowing black members or black... My Mormon knowledge is still kind of lax, I'm sorry. But same. Thank you. But the same thing with that. Like, things had to change because as society shifts, if the church wants to remain relevant, they have to shift with it. They just have to. So, and that's how it's been through all history. Yes, sir.
You mentioned a couple times the word eschaton. Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with that. Could you explain that?
Yeah.
How it relates to what you're saying?
Okay, so how I define eschaton, and I think some people might define it a little bit differently than I do, but I define it as a particular moment. It is the end of the present, and it is the beginning of eternity, but the eternity is not the eschaton. Does that make sense? So the eschaton is this final moment of linear time. So if we did it on here,
that's the eschaton. That's the end of life as we, it's the end of the world as we know it. And then the future happens, and it's a new start.
It comes from the word like a judgment day or something.
Yeah, so it's that idea of like this judgment day, this ultimate end of everything. So that's the last chapter, that's the last page, it's over, it's done, and then eternity is able to begin after that.
Does that relate to what the present end in Greek?
Mm-hmm.
So this is just in our mentality, is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. So this future moment where they're able to get married in the temple and bring back these moments of eternity, they're stepping over that eschaton moment and they're coming back into the present. So, and they're able to constantly do that through particular having children, having sex, whatever. So, is that cool?
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Yes. What time do we have? I don't know what time we have. There's a clock over there.
Yeah, 12:20.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah.
We got a little bit of time. Go ahead.
So, my gay Mormon friends and my liberal Mormon friends.
We're a lot of fun, aren't we?
This change. Mm-hmm. How's it going to happen?
I think a better question is, should it happen? So, like...
It's more immoral to let gay youth die.
I agree. So I have a weird stance on this. One side of me, like, sees this and is like, yes, this is a problem, and yes, the church should change. But at the end of the day, we all want religious freedom, we all want to have the beliefs that we want to have. So then we have to ask the question of, should this change? You know?
So gay's still way too small of
No.
We're nothing. We're small, little.
I mean, we're a small community, but at the same time, we can't twist the church's arm and say you have to change this now. It's not possible.
We're a little minority.
Yeah, but little minorities make a lot of noise.
Allies get bigger.
Yeah. Well, and the LGBT community's allies are huge, and like, I mean, so look at what the church just did. Like, they just contributed a lot of money to the Pride, to the Utah Pride, yeah. And I tell people all the time, okay, so when marriage equality was the law of the land, all my evangelical Christian friends messaged me and they said really awful things to me, but every single one of my Mormon friends messaged me and they said, we are so happy that this just happened. We are so happy for you. This is amazing. So there's a shift happening in the church with the younger generation, but I don't think it's our responsibility, much less our job, to demand that it happen any quicker, whether we be gay Mormon or whether we be liberal Mormons. The idea has to come from the church itself. You know, it has to be a moment of rupture. Because if it's not the church's idea, and it's not the church's desire to change, then it'll be a half-assed attempt at giving us equality. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I kind of stole that from you.
your pulse on Mormonism is a small, you said, right?
Yes. Kind of. I mean, I was raised in Pocatello, so I was raised around it.
Two prophets just died. So
really?
Voted another two, right?
Right.
But the topic on gays is real big right now. So they're not going to pick two allies to be two new apostles.
But you know what? They might. Because you know what? It really comes down to, the church has made amazing strides in LGBT acceptance. Like, y'all are so lucky you live in Salt Lake City. And I'm sorry that, like, that's... I live in Nashville, and you would, or live south of Nashville, and you would think that Nashville would be pretty liberal. It's not. Man, it's not. Like, the fact that you have a governing body like the church that's pushing for LGBT protections in employment and in housing and stuff, like, that's huge. And, like, that would have never happened 10 years ago, 5 years ago even. You know, and they're trying to push that kind of protection in Nashville, and it is not going anywhere. So it's amazing that you have the church body that is saying, you know, we don't necessarily agree with this, but we accept that it's not just a choice. We accept that we don't get it, but we believe that everyone deserves equal protections. And maybe in our religion, we're not going to give them the right to marry yet, but we're going to make sure that we are Christ-like in the way that we deal with people on a civil level. So, like, I have nothing but, like, huge applause for the way that the church is starting to move forward in that direction. And I might be kind of at odds with some of y'all, and I apologize if I am, but I think it's a huge step in the right direction, especially from where I'm coming from in Nashville, where you can't go anywhere without seeing anti-LGBT things. So, yes.
I was going to say, I don't see this ever changing until the doctrine becomes less tied to gender roles.
Yes. Yep, because gender roles are huge.
That's the whole reason behind it, yeah.
And something, as we watch history happening, something we've noticed, or you notice, is that first the blacks get equal rights, and then the women start to get equal rights, and then other people start to get equal rights. And if you look at our presidency, you know, we have our first, like, mixed president, and we're very close to coming to having our first woman president. And if that's any indication of how history works, the church will move as society moves. It has to. To remain relevant, the church has to change. So, I think it'll be really hard to twist their patriarchal sensibilities, though. So, I thought I saw another hand. Anybody else? No? Okay, y'all can go to lunch. Thank you for coming.